Accession number 29424, Reel 8.
I mean, the Chinese learnt from the Russian collapse. The Chinese knew if they did what the Russians had done, China would have collapsed into feudal local warlords running China, the way it had been long ago under weak emperors. So the Chinese learnt their lesson from the Russians not to do the same.
But I suppose with the gas monopoly now and the way that is being treated, that would be a good example, wouldn't it? Putin, you know, and his methods going back.
Yes, I mean, they have recognised now that it's about power. And as long as we have all the power in our hand, and the power is an economic thing. In that sense, Marx is right. The economy does determine things. So they haven't got a strong state, but they're building a strong economy based on a few things like oil.
It was interesting when the Eastern European countries, you know, the system collapsed one after the other.
Yeah,
East Germans, a lot of people were saying this will never happen to the GDR. But of course it did, you know, in 1989 the wall came down. I wonder what you, knowing so much about Germany, as you do, Paul, and coming indeed from Germany, what you made of reunification, which came after 1989, of course, and whether you have any, you know, was it all a good thing for the GDR? Were there sort of drawbacks to this?
Huge drawbacks, but it was inevitable that it should happen. Of course, the collapse of the GDR cannot be in any way compared to the collapse of the Soviet Union. The collapse of the GDR was the result of the collapse of the Soviet Union. The GDR never rested on the assent of the majority of its people. The GDR rested on Soviet bayonets, the presence of the Red Army. Everybody in East Germany settled for the system and decided, well, we'll make the best of it and we'll make it work as well as we can. We have no choice. We can't overthrow it because the Russians are so powerful and any attempt to have a revolution here might start a world war, and nobody wants that. So the average East German settled down to a condition of what they thought was pretty permanent, because they thought the Soviet Union was pretty permanent. So the system worked reasonably well. It worked better than the system did in Russia, because you could argue they were more. They were building on a stronger society to start with, and they had different traditions. They had reasonably good technical ability, not up to the Western standards, but good enough to give their population the best standard of living in Eastern Europe, not up to Western standards, but it was okay. But all the time, the majority of the people envied West Germany and felt, well, we are being forcibly separated from West Germany by this Russian presence. The average East German spent every evening, and that included the communist officials, watching West German television. So they were well informed. They did have the Eastern version as well, so they could actually compare. They could compare East German television with West German television. West Germans never bothered to do that. They watched their own, but I don't think it ever occurred to them to watch the East German version. But the East Germans could do both. And, of course, West Germany was very much more prosperous. They saw the pictures of the full supermarkets. They saw how the average West German lived. They had to wait 3 years to get a little Trabant car, which was antediluvian in its in its quality. And they knew that every West German worker had a car. You know, it was about living standards, economic living standards. The average person, it wasn't about political freedom, but for the intellectuals it was. And they wanted political freedom. The churches wanted a free society for theological reasons, and not a Marxist one that made their life so difficult, or they weren't actively persecuted, but their life was difficult. So that everybody was longing for reunification. And so the moment people realized and were basically promised by the Russians, we will not interfere with you anymore. I mean, Gorbachev actually said the people of Eastern Europe must determine their own fate. Hundreds of thousands went onto the streets and said, you know, we are the people. And that was the first slogan in Leipzig on the streets. And a week later, they changed the slogan to, we are one people. In other words, that means we want reunification. And there was, of course, a fear that the communists would shoot and do what the Chinese had done in Tiananmen Square. But in the end, the communist leadership in Germany knew if we shoot, the Russians won't come in and help us, and the people are stronger, and maybe the West Germans will come in, and we'll be hung from the lamppost if that happens. So the communist leadership just surrendered to the streets. And after that, the fact that they then rushed into unification was probably psychologically inevitable. I think if they'd made it a process over 5 or 6 years, it would have been much, in the long run, it would have been much healthier. But I accept that it was probably impossible. The impetus was too great. It is what they wanted, what the East German people wanted. I don't think the West German people cared much either way. They were perfectly happy the way they were. And they were basically saying, well, if the East Germans want to join us, let them. If they don't want to join us, okay, they can go on being like they were before. It didn't affect the average person in West Germany. Except that once they did get united, the average person in West Germany suddenly saw his living standards going down. Because the West German state then had to step in and subsidize the East German one to slowly bring it up to the same standard and pour a lot of resources into the East. So the West Germans then started being resentful and saying, oh, these lazy East Germans who spent 40 years being lazy and never doing anything decent, and now we got to bail them out. And the East Germans, after about 6 months of this, started feeling they're colonizing us and telling us how to be true Germans. So the paradox was they felt one people while the wall was still there, and they discovered when the wall had gone that they weren't, that they'd got so different in their mentalities. They hadn't realized it when they were forced to be apart, but when they were suddenly no longer apart, as the Germans said, the wall in people's minds was higher than ever. And of course, the discrepancy is still huge. Unemployment in Germany is high, but it's three times as high in the East as in the West. So the East Germans feel all the young people are emigrating west because they've got jobs to go to. There isn't a city in East Germany without massive blocks of flats that were built for them standing empty. A heavy drift of population from east to west. And there are pockets where this is different. The West has invested hugely in the cities of Dresden and Leipzig, and they've become new centres of, I mean, they put new factories in, they've, you know, Volkswagen and Mercedes-Benz and so on, they're building cars in Leipzig, and and Volkswagen is building cars in Dresden, and you know, they've got a few centres of excellence now in the East, which is just like the West. But the provincial areas in the north of East Germany are rapidly depopulating, with only old people in the villages and no young people left. So there are huge problems. But people say they're not bigger than the problems of the contrast between northern Italy and southern Italy. Huge discrepancies of living standards within one country, which is reflected to some degree in Britain. Still a north-south divide in Britain. So it's more acute now in Germany after the reunification, but it's a phenomenon that's not uniquely German.
And probably they will give, as you say, time is of the essence.
Time will definitely heal it.
Yeah. How about, what do you think of the rise of neo-Nazism in the East? That there seem to be a lot of anti-Semitism.
Well, this is not just East Germany, this is the whole of Eastern Europe. They have had no practice at all in multiculturalism. In the West, France, Spain, Britain, West Germany with its huge influx of Turks. West European society has problems with it, but it's become multicultural. In other words, yes, there are big problems, the French, very big in France, but nevertheless, we've learned to live with large minorities of a different skin colour and certainly of a different mentality. And we more or less manage. The East Europeans have had absolutely no experience of this whatever. They've been absolutely monolithic societies. In East Germany, they had a few people from Vietnam, for example, and a few people from Angola and Mozambique who were left-wing African countries, who were, they were training in East Germany. What did they do? They put them in isolated camps and kept them away from the local population. So these Germans had absolutely no experience of any other culture. And it's the same in Poland, it's the same in Russia, where there is no such thing as political correctness that says you mustn't be racist. They're quite openly racist. They're still openly anti-Semitic in places like Poland and there are Ukraine and so on. That's what's making so many Jews now. Where are the Jews fleeing to? Those that don't want to go to Israel go to Germany. Germany, which tried to murder every Jew in the world, has now almost reached the Jewish size of its population that it had before Hitler. East European Jews are flooding into Germany.
Supreme irony.
And of course the Germans have a bad conscience about it and feel we owe so much to the Jews we can't stop them coming. They have an almost free right of entry. And total ironies. And sadly, that's led to young East Germans and young, I think there are similar developments apparently in other East European countries, when they see a black face and they start seeing a number of black faces and asylum seekers and so on, they let all their frustrations out on them, and some of them do it because it's kind of sexy. They put on Nazi symbols and I mean they're very ill-educated, they don't even know what Nazism is about anymore. But it's you know, it had pretty uniforms in the past, and it was anti-communist, and they've now been taught that communism is a bad thing and it's collapsed, so the opposite must be all right. You know, so you get the older generation with still Nazi influences present in them, not most of them, but enough of them to not stop young people from being like that. And I don't think it's very significant, actually. I don't think it's huge. I mean, I don't think there are more neo-fascists in East Germany than there are in some West European countries. But it gets a lot of publicity, obviously. I mean, you know, there is a lot of racism in Britain, which is more or less acknowledged now, and you know, people get beaten up, or a few even get killed because of where they come from. Well, if that happens in East Germany, it gets much bigger publicity than it happens anywhere else. So I don't think the problem is quite as bad as some people make it out to be, but it certainly exists.
Do you have, or perhaps I ought to ask you about your run-in with the Stasi files. This, you had a problem here, I remember, Paul, and I wondered if you could explain what it was all about and what it meant to you.
Well, of course, my many years of commuting, I might almost say, from the West to East Germany, in my various roles in the church, I think I added my visits to East Germany up once, and it came to 77 from 1986 to 1990. 1956 to 1990, I think I visited East Germany 77 times. Well, quite inevitably, somebody with an official job in the West concerned with relationships with Eastern Europe drew to himself the undivided attention of the East German security system. And the Russian one as well. So both the KGB and the East German state security, called Stasi, obviously kept a close eye on me, much closer than in a certain naivete I had assumed. I always knew that I was of interest to them, but I never thought I was of that much interest to them, as it turned out after the event. But I did know, because it was open and public, that the East Germans also, as it were, had apportioned a senior Stasi official to me. Now, very cleverly psychologically, I think, they decided to do this openly. His name was Dr. Hans-Joachim Zadowski. He had communist parents who were murdered by the Nazis. He was Jewish in background, which was like my background. He was a young idealist when he started, and he studied philosophy at the Humboldt University. He was extremely interested in religion. And in fact, he wrote his doctoral thesis on the relationship between the Kremlin and the Vatican between the two world wars. So Catholicism was really his hobby almost, as a communist. And I knew perfectly well that he worked for the East German security. And he wanted me to know. He never said it in so many words. But he befriended me, and I accepted his friendship. I thought, I knew he had influential friends. And he used to say to me, if you ever need my help to help anybody in our country who gets into trouble, I'm influential enough to help. And he proved it on various occasions. In other words, he wanted to win my confidence. And in a sense, he did. But he was honest enough to say to me once, don't tell me anything you don't want our state to know. Because what you tell me doesn't stay with me. In other words, I report to the boss about our conversations. And so you can regard me as a suitable conveyor of information to the boss. In other words, tell me what you want me to tell them, and they'll find out. So I had this ambivalent relationship with a senior officer of the East German state security. And the evidence now is that he was so senior that the normal state security system didn't know about him, didn't know that he was doing this. He was doing it over their heads. All the reports on me by the state security branch church, I have read. They are now open to be read by so-called victims, and I was a so-called victim, people on whom they keep a file. So I've read all 700 pages of their files on me. He never appears. He is never mentioned. He doesn't exist as far as those files are concerned. Lower down people kept a secret eye on me. He wrote reports on me to the very top, and they didn't know anything about this. In other words, they have a very sophisticated system of controls. And that, of course, was, you can say we were using each other as an official of the Western churches. I was using him to convey what I and the churches thought about the regime. And eventually, I wasn't only able to read my file, the Stasi's file on me, I was able to read his file, in other words, his reports to the top, which exist in 17 volumes. And I had access to all these 17 volumes of his reports to the very top of the system. And recurrently, occasionally, I pop up in these reports.
Was he saying what you wanted him to say?
Absolutely. I've read them. I mean, he kept his word. He wrote down, you know, and it was very, very interesting, you know, that he, that there was a sense in which I could trust him. And having read his reports on me, and he also did what saved me from being regarded as a communist informer. He could have given me a cover name, which they did for some people, as a communist informer, as a secret informer. If he'd done that, after the collapse of communism, my reputation in the West would absolutely ruined. I'd look like a collaborator with the communist system. But he didn't. He always did his reports on me as there's a German word for it, the Abschöpfung, that means the Abschöpfung des Österreicher, in other words, the reports on Österreicher. Not the reports of Österreicher, but the reports on Österreicher. It's a subtle difference. He's reporting on me. He's not handing over my reports. He's not turning me into an agent. He could have done that. And it's happened to other people, quite innocent people, who've been pilloried for doing exactly what I did. But they were listed differently. It's a very subtle thing. So I had that relationship with the Stasi, which means that he is a friend in inverted commas, and I put inverted commas with that word, to this day. I've never lost contact with him. I felt he kept faith with me. Why should I refuse to have lunch with him now? And so we can have very interesting conversations now looking back on that period. But he is as guarded and as much of a Secret Service agent today as he was then. I mean, in other words, openness is not the game he plays. It's a subtle. He is still in his mindset the top Stasi official he always was. He's not going to give away secrets from that time, from that period in the past, to me or anybody else. And I was simply part of his system. And so to speak of friendship would really be a misnomer, but a fascinating mutual kind of respect that we have for each other.